Okay, I have a very big problem today in that I have absolutely no idea whatsoever what to talk about. I have no idea what to speak about today, and I could speak about the fact that I have no idea what to speak about. And that's actually not a bad topic to talk about. Sometimes things don't lend themselves to explanations. Sometimes explanations get in the way of situations. Sometimes we have difficulties. Sometimes we have, obstacles appear, situations appear which are far beyond our control. And often in these situations that are appearing that are far beyond our control, we become confused because we like to be in control. And it seems anyway that how you respond to these situations is going to be the key to the future of your life. Now, I know it's very unusual for people who speak and discuss and do personal development education or spiritual education or something to simply say, well, I'm totally bewildered as but what to speak about. I don't really understand things very clearly right now. But the reality of the situation is right now, that's how I feel. Now, I could, of course, just pull some topic from the air and start talking about it and pretend that I have it all together. And it would be a fairly boring and uninteresting lecture, but some people would like it. Some people would say, oh, that was not very exciting. But the worst part would be is that I would feel badly about myself. The reality of my present situation is that there are many, many forces impacting me from all different directions, and probably also the influence of the full moon and other things. So I find it very hard to come up with a specific thing to speak about that would be relevant to me. Now, some people have made a theory that the only time you could really come to clarity is from times of complete confusion and bewilderment. I remember there was one economist from the university who worked with the government in Sweden who lived next door to our farm in Almvik in Sweden. And he had this theory, and he used Arjuna's situation on the battlefield of Kurukshetra to prove his thesis, because he said without confusion, without a lot of clouds, there can be no resolution and advancement. I always found that to be interesting because in many respects that's true. In fact, that's probably why we're all here in the first place. After all, if everything's perfect, there's no stimulus, there's no resistance to anything we do, and therefore there's no work performed, and therefore there's no satisfaction from having performed work. Sometimes people think that if everything would work perfectly all the time, then they would be happy. But when things do work perfectly, that also creates another state of mind, like where one becomes lazy, or one becomes unchallenged, where one is not challenged in one's capacity. This is one of the biggest problems that people face when they retire. They've been active their whole lives, and then all of a sudden they have nothing to do or nothing they have to do. So then they piddle around here and there doing little of this, a little of that. So what actually happens is that people become rather understimulated. They become rather uninspired in their lives. And because they become rather uninspired, life does not have the same meaning it had before. And life without meaning is not life at all. what you find meaning in is unique to you, but still everybody has to find some meaning. Otherwise, those who have meaningless lives are often existentialists or people in very bad shape. So I understand in my own life that these periods of difficulty in the sense of lack of clarity, lack of direction, lack of motivation in a particular field or manner, these are introductory phases or preliminary phases to something new which is being arranged. You know, as we know, we live near a community of devotees, and sometimes we have association, and I think one of the biggest problems is that when you think you have it all understood and that it all fits within a certain package, all the things that don't fit within that package simply have to be thrown away or not bothered with, or they're all just delusion, which makes life quite complex. Yet at the same time, when you allow all these influences into your life, in other words, you accept all the aspects of existence that come to you, there is an enormous responsibility there, because all of a sudden you're not protected from these things by a philosophy or something else. It's just you have to deal with it all. It's now your responsibility. Now, some people like having a life which is already delineated for them, already put in a box, already packaged, formulated, so they don't have to think. They don't have to think about all of these decisions which normally take up a lot of time, and they can devote themselves to, as they think, higher forms of spiritual activity. Other people find it rather difficult when all of their decisions are made for them and all of their aspects of life are prepackaged and formulated. They rather feel the excitement of going out and discovering, of uncovering, of facing challenges and conquering them, and feeling a great satisfaction about what they are or what they have become, what they've made of themselves. Now, for those who are in a formulated, packaged situation, they think it's fine for some time, but at one point they start facing these challenges anyway, because life is meant for evolutionary challenges. So they come to you in other forms. Sometimes those forms are in the form of opposition from other persons or governments or family members or even people within your group. It seems that we as human beings seek out these challenges, thirst and hunger for these challenges, even if we try to avoid them by accepting something so packaged and formulated, we thought when we entered into it there would be none of these things. And yet at the same time, when we're in these situations of challenges, we're always lamenting, we're always striving, we're always seeking out, searching out a way to get around these things, to be freed from these troubles so we can have peace. And yet when we get to peace, we say, this is too much, this peace. I need some challenge. I need some stimulation. Now, it would be interesting at this point to talk about the difference between a challenge and obstacles, or something which is, in the term of obstacles, something which is has negativity to it, like struggling against forces in a way which is just not working right. If you talk about a challenge is something where there's a task, there's a situation, there's something to overcome, there's something to do. And when you accept the challenge, you can become very inspired by it. It gives you a lot of energy. It gives you a lot of satisfaction. It gives you a lot of meaning in life, a direction. And gradually overcoming that challenge in a successful way, step by step by step, can be one of the most enlivening things you can do. On the other hand, when you're faced with obstacles which just weigh you down, which wear down your energy, which are just trying to deal with a negative thing, just like if somebody says something negative about you and you have to counter that all the time, or it's just lousy weather all the time. You have to counter that all the time. If there's economic problems, you have to counter that all the time. That's quite different than facing a challenge in a progressive way. So it seems that this fight that we are forced to undergo falls into the category of hard struggle for existence. And challenges that we accept and face with enthusiasm, especially when we can do something positive with them, is in the category of progressive evolution. Well, ultimately, this distinction between these two is artificial. It is not really on a higher level the most important distinction. It's rather something which we create because we feel bad about one and we feel good about the other. I would suppose the situation could be boiled down to, in a sense, what we feel good about, what we feel bad about in life. We feel good about a positive challenge. We feel bad about obstacles and struggles. And therefore, the key to dealing with that could be to simply adjust the way we feel about the situations we're in. Of course, that's easier said than done. Because there are other factors involved which are out of our control, back to the beginning. For example, there may be struggles and obstacles that attach to our body, which make us feel uncomfortable or full of pain. That's not just a state of mind. That's a factual, physical reality you have to deal with. There can be situations which are so intolerable, situations which are so beyond our capacity to deal with, that they create mental anxiety of such a degree that it's out of control. There can be losses, there can be pain, there can be unavoidable circumstances from people around us, from the political situation, from the world around us, which is far out of our control. Often people who are in a fairly reasonable situation speak about being even-minded, being equipoised, being able with a positive attitude to accept all situations in life. But a mother of six children in Africa who's starving, whose children are starving, she also has diseases, maybe she was constantly beaten by her husband, has absolutely no way to get out of the situation, yet still loves the children, wants to do something. Talking about these things to her doesn't seem to make sense. On one hand, one could say that these discussions are the realm of the prosperous, or the realm of those who live in places where such possibilities are available. Now, on one hand, that seems kind of unfair. Yet on the other hand, it seems to be a product of long-term evolution. It also seems that when one is blessed with a situation which is somewhat comfortable so that one can ask such questions about life and can do something about it, that if you do not take that, next lifetime you may have to be forced into a situation where difficulties are there in life to such a degree that you develop the thirst to question. So when we are personally in states of confusion or personally in states of doubt, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Actually, it's probably a very great impetus to research, to figure it out, to make a study, understand that. Confusion is not something to be denigrated, something to be criticized, something to be avoided at all costs. It's just something that comes when it comes, and it has its purpose in life. Therefore, the statement, "This too shall pass," is very applicable. The wonderful thing about time is that over time, all situations resolve. They resolve quicker if you let them go, if you let them resolve. They resolve much slower if you fight that resolution. If you're fighting your, capacity to understand the reasons behind activities in the past, or if you are refusing to deal with these activities of the past, your situation will not resolve very rapidly. The only way to resolve these situations is to let them go, let them be, or if you need to make some statement to close the situation, as in an apology or perhaps in an explanation to others or to do something good for the other persons or whatever. But resolving these things is essential for all of us. Otherwise, our present confusion will remain always confused because of the attachment we have to the past. And don't forget, our confusion about the past translates into confusion in the present, because it's right now we are confused about the past. So what do you do when you're confused? You have to research, find out facts, figure out what went wrong and what is wrong in you that allows you to participate in that which was wrong. And here we find the advantage of not being in a packaged box situation, of actually being in that dangerous ground of the freedom to understand. Basically, there's two kinds of researchers. One kind of researcher is the person who has already in their mind the exact understanding of what a situation is, and is going out to figure out how to find facts which relate to that situation. In other words, they already have a conclusion, and they're going to find facts which support their conclusion. Now, naturally, this kind of research, although it has been used in science often, is not very scientific. It's been used, for example, in the evolutionary researches for proving Darwin's theory. There was this theory, and then people just went out looking for evidence to support it, and all the evidence that didn't support it, they just threw away. That's what that book, Forbidden Archaeology, is addressing. All of the facts which were thrown away because they didn't fit with the conclusion. Now, having the strength to research with a neutral and open mind means you don't already have an opinion about what the result should be. You're just looking for the right result, the correct result. So I have seen that many people deal with their past, many people deal with the confusion that they're in right now about the past by trying to find evidence that supports what they already think. Now, using common sense, what is the point of that? You already think that way, and you're already confused. Now, do you think that finding more proof is going to make you less confused? That I don't think so. You already think this way because you have proof in your own mind, which was enough to give you this opinion. So finding more of that proof, according to whatever your definition of proof is not really going to change anything. It's just going to make you feel more confident about what is already making you confused. Now, the way to deal with that is to simply say, yes, I believe it fully. It is absolutely proved. I accept it 100%. I'll never question it again. But what an opportunity is lost. Later on in your life, when you look back on your life, without a doubt, at one point you're going to think, I lost a marvelous opportunity to research about reality. These states of confusion are very useful. They are indicators. They are signposts. They are ways to lead you to clarity. And sometimes this confusion continues to cause one to research from a neutral point of view, to just try to see, history. Just try to see facts. Just try to see what is, rather than making it to be what you think it should be or should have been. It's like if you have an idea of the way things should have been, and you simply try to figure out the reasons why it wasn't like that, you're making two mistakes in your research. The first mistake is that you think it should have been a certain way, because there is no should. Things are what they are. But you feel it should have been a certain way. That's the first mistake. The second mistake, of course you can always say something's better or worse, or could have been better or worse. That's another thing. And the second mistake is to then try to prove why it wasn't that way by selectively examining the past. Now, on one hand, there's not necessarily anything wrong with wanting things to have been in a certain way and trying to prove why they weren't that particular way. However, what's wrong with it in the sense of not the best for you is that you will always be stuck to thinking what you've already thought or are thinking now. It doesn't give rise to progressive change. Now, we believe what we believe because it makes us feel good to believe it. Otherwise, we wouldn't believe it. We accept values because there's things which we feel we take shelter in those values. They somehow make us feel better. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best way to be. For there are many situations in life which don't fit in a formula, don't fit in a preconceived, packaged box. Even those who lived in religious societies, for instance, found out rapidly that even though everything was placed within a package, it did not deal with the reality of our situations. It is very difficult. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of faith in yourself to simply say, I only want to know what is, and I will not mind whatever it is. I will accept it. Whatever I am, I am. Whatever you are, you are. Whatever our relationship is, it is. Whatever the world around us is, it is. It is so much better, in my opinion, to know what is than to try to force everything to be what I think it should be. I've often heard the statement that we should not think of ourselves the controllers. Yet, if we insist that everything fit within a certain package, we are taking the roles as controllers who insist that things should be a certain way. Hello? We missed that whole last translation. Can you repeat it? And when you understand you're not the controller, you understand that you have no right to enforce your perception upon others. You have no right to enforce your perception upon the world. And rather, you just accept what is rather than seeing it as it should be. But at that point, it takes a lot of courage to live, because finding your way through that confusion can be incredibly difficult, yet it can give you incredible strength. Just consider the situation in the Mahabharata. The whole Mahabharata is an incredible moral history, or a history of values and a history of peace and confusion and the way these two forces deal with each other. Although the individuals within that history basically were following certain moral and cultural patterns, the actual history itself was filled with breakage of every convention and rule you could think of. The way the Pandavas were thrown out of the kingdom, the way Draupadi was lost in a gambling match, the way they were in the forest, the way they had to fight in the battlefield, all of the immoral and unjust things that happened to them. These things were all out of the box, and you can't imagine the confusion that must have been there in their minds in many respects. And why were there all of these situations which were so unjust, improper? Well, all of this confusion was a catalyst for creating something new, for taking a situation which was accepted as the status quo and putting it to a new level, a new evolutionary level. Now, naturally, our lives are not as complex as the Mahabharata time. The stakes of that are involved in our daily lives are nowhere as near as valuable. Basically speaking, our lives seem to be quite different. Yet, we face the same kind of situations in our life all the time. Yet, at the same time, we can be quite sure of the fact that our confusion, our doubtful situations can and will lead to a greater understanding, a greater realization, and greater experiences that will give us great strength if we allow them to. And therefore, I suggested that one research the past, research your feelings, research the reality around you right now with an unbiased eye. Just see it as it is, without preconceptions. That's very difficult, but try it. Try to see it from other points of view. Try to look at it from the point of view of another person. Just like I've given people the exercise. Like if you want to know how other people feel, reverse the roles. Reverse the roles. Put yourself in their shoes and speak to yourself as you have been speaking to them. Stand in their situation and see how it feels to be considered the way they are considered. It is very healthy. It is incredibly healthy to use role reversal as a way to understand the pain others feel by the perceptions and conceptions we place upon them. Research means sometimes to see things you just don't want to see. How many businessmen have lost their businesses because while the business was going on, they refused to look at the weaknesses of their company and see the certain pattern of destruction? How many marriages have been lost because people refused to see the weaknesses of their relationship, the defects in their relationship, and because they refused to see it, they refused to talk about it? How many people have gotten sick because they refused to see the effect of food on their physical bodies? And how many people have become spiritually lost because they refused to see the effect of a particular practice on their self, on their soul? Anyway, I'm sure you understand this point quite well, and there's really no need to discuss it further. It's just that I'm, I suppose, doing a pep talk here to get everybody to understand that there's nothing wrong with, or there's nothing unconquerable to be found when you just try to see things as they are rather than making them as you think they should be. Now, since I started off this discussion talking about my own particular confusion about my situation right now, after hearing myself talk about it, well, I've learned one thing. This too shall pass, and it shall become clear in due course of time. And my situation now is a product of my choices of the past, and I should just accept that without lamenting about them, but just accepting them for what they are so I can see possibilities for the future. It's either do that or just ignore it completely, repress it completely, and basically ruin life. So I'd like to ask now for questions, if anybody has any questions they'd like to discuss about this point. I have been told by this, about this, and in fact I have also experienced this, that as you go on in life, as you develop and as you change in your situations, you need different personalities to help you, to guide you, or to assist you in life, just as you have parents when you're young, and you have teachers and friends when you're a little older, and you have your wife and family when you're older still. So similarly, all of those persons who guide you, they are changing as you need it. They are evolving in their assistance to you as you need it over time. At a particular point of time, it might be required that you get some assistance in a particular way from some persons. They're there to help you. And then in other times, other persons, they're there to help you. And at other times, you can have situations where somebody would be with you consistently or constantly, especially if they wish to and you wish to too. Did that help? Did that answer address the point exactly that you wish to address? Okay, I have another question here. That we perceive the situation that we are presently in through all of our accumulated conceptions. Therefore, the question comes, how is it possible to see things as they are if all of your perceptions are colored by that particular media of accumulated conceptions, or in other words, your consciousness, the way your consciousness has developed as a product of all of those conceptions? Good question. This is a good question because it addresses two very significant points. The first point is that we are aware of the fact that our perception right now is totally colored by our consciousness. And number two, that despite that, we endeavor to scientifically, quote unquote, understand how to filter out our conception from a historical fact or reality. First of all, simply being aware of your filtering function, of the filtering function of your consciousness, is immediately a very positive step towards coming to reality. Even more importantly, the more aware you are of the energy of your consciousness, the state of your consciousness, the way your consciousness feels to you, the closer you are to self-realization. And strangely enough, the closer you are to self-realization, the less important historical facts are, the less important your discovering by the experimental process everything that has influenced you, because you'll be able to see it directly by just simply having that clear consciousness of the aware. But if you are not yet at that point of complete awareness, then dealing with the situations of the past, even if you know that you're filtering them, becomes a challenge, and it becomes a positive challenge. The way to see the reality of the situation rather than the way I only saw, only the way I saw the situation. Now, let's face it, reality is a very, very subjective experience. Very subjective. Let's say I had a nice statue in my room. Somebody comes up and it breaks. According to the way I wish to see that person and see the situation, I can create reality accordingly. If I've seen that this person is awkward and careless in their life, well, I will immediately assume that they were careless and awkward and caused this statue to break. If my experience, right or wrong, these things, but these are just our perception, was that this person was envious or full of hatred, then we will assume that they have broken the statue out of hatred and envy for us. In other words, we see the things that happen from the point of view of our perception of people. So the best way to overcome that prejudice or bias is to look from the eyes of that person, to try to understand that person. One could do it, for example, by asking the person and saying it in such a way that they would understand that you're not angry, you just really want to know why, that's all, and listen carefully to what they say. But a real researcher would also observe the way a person is and try to understand what makes them tick. So you've got a person's history, the way a person has reacted in certain situations, what they are saying, how you perceive they are feeling, any new influences in their life, and so on. All of these things can be taken into consideration. So a scientific research has to include all these things. But the main way to overcome the difficulty of our sensory capacity or our perceptive capacity being colored is to look to examine all of the facts of a situation without trying to make any of the facts fit any of our conceptions. That's the best means. And generally, you will have a good opportunity to do so the more you want to do so. There are some people who just don't want to do so. I run into it all the time with people who are trying to understand me, trying to understand why I left ISKCON, trying to understand why I do what I do. Some of them do not want to know. They just like keeping their conceptions that they had. They don't want to know anything else, even if they say they do. They really don't. So you can explain all you want day and night. They're not going to understand. That's just the way it is. When we have a particular desire not to do something, others don't make us do that thing. We can't be forced to do that. So it is our desire to see things clearly which directs and powers and gives us the capacity to see things clearly. That means you just simply open yourself up to what is rather than what you think. That's why our meditation on the deities, simply accepting the energy of the deities, it works so well because it doesn't depend on our preconceived notions. We just accept the deity's energy as it is right now, right there, right in front of us. But if you walk in thinking, oh, I can't perceive the energy of the deity because I am fallen, I am foolish, I am dull, I am sinful, and they are so great, so beyond, they don't care about me, that I can't connect to them, then you never will. But then again, if somebody comes in and states that, oh, I am great, I can do it, I am wonderful, I have the capacity, I am fully empowered, and so on, then their consciousness is colored by their own conception of themselves, which has become a major situation. So one has to go in with a neutral conception. Neither that I'm so bad, neither that I'm so great. I am simply what I am. And I want to accept what you are. I want to accept the deity's energy. I want to accept my guides or my angels or whatever. I just want to accept without putting in my conception, either good or bad, of myself. Did that help answer your question? But if you find yourself already under the influence of your old programs or programming and feel terrible, maybe there is some technique or meditation which can help improve the condition of your consciousness. Yes, that is the technique of acceptance, simply acceptance. In fact, that meditation we have already done, that's already there on the website, the the meditation on just simply acceptance. It's a question of acceptance. When your consciousness is colored by preconceptions, the best solution is to simply accept things and let things come to you rather than you have to manipulate them. And that acceptance can come in the form of simply listening to what others say, or listening to your heart, or just listening, or just seeing, just accepting what is around you. It's a very simple technique. Rather than you putting your energy out, you just accept what's coming in and observe, to be an observer. Those who observe have a unique possibility to see things that those who are actively interacting with the world cannot. Okay, and here we have a question which is about some subject which I'm not sure where it's coming from, but okay, let's just accept it. They say, if a person robs, they think it's okay. They have this feeling that stealing is okay. And they justify it for some reason. They rationalize it as being okay for some reason. But the reality may be that the person steals money out of greed. So, is it okay? I don't understand what the question means, is it okay? But let's discuss this. Well, let's just think about this from a very detached point of view for a second. Everybody who steals does so because they think that they have a good reason for doing it. They think there is some reason for them to do it. But ultimately, they are taking because they want to have what another person has. But whether or not it's okay, well, okay for who? That's the question. It's not okay for the person who was stolen from because they're losing something they didn't want to lose. Whether it's okay for the person who steals, I suppose, is up to their consciousness, up to their feelings of guilt, and whether or not they got away with it, or whether they felt they should. So one wonders what okay is supposed to mean. Here, just tell me. Hello, you're on. Okay, here it is. I'll turn you off then. This is in relation about seeing things from the point of view of the other person. Ah, I didn't catch that. Okay. Sure. But that's not what I meant. I wasn't referring to stealing and things like that. But stealing or having somebody cause pain to you by insult or by making politic to ruin a particular situation you're in, or even by doing something good for you. Certainly all of these things, when you see them from the point of view of the other person, amplify your consciousness. I never said you'd feel good about that, that after you do that, you'd feel good. That wasn't the point for you to feel good. It's the point is to understand. If you understand that, say, the thief is a greedy person, well, then you understand more about what makes that person tick, that person is influenced by greed. And that's the particular mode or characteristic of their consciousness. And they have a long way to go to get over that. You can forgive them for their greed, but not that you feel good about what they do. You don't want them to, for example, steal again. You'll do whatever you can do to stop them from stealing again. Yet, you do understand why they do steal. Understanding something and feeling good about it or sanctioning it are two totally different things. But ignoring the reasons people do what they do doesn't help either. Okay, so I suppose the question is asking about the differentiation between love that we might normally perceive it and divine love. I suppose that's the question. Let's think of it in another way. And let's try to answer this question in an unusual way without referring to ways in which we have been taught or we may have preconceptions about. Let's consider that love is a spiritual quality. Love is a divine quality. That when we're actually speaking about love, it's a divine quality that is spiritual in nature all the time, in all realms, everywhere, that energy of love. Let's just assume that. Now, I know that this is contrary to what you may have been thinking. That's why you asked the question, like to make a distinction between the two. But I'm saying let's not make a distinction between the two and answer the question that way. Because after all, if you have to start qualifying love, well, there's this kind of love, that kind of love, that kind of love, that kind of love. What you are really doing is saying there is love, and then there are things which are not really love. This love that we feel, that energy is love, but when it is mixed with other things, it changes in quality. It becomes an alloy. Therefore, when you talk about pure love, you're talking about unalloyed love. For after all, there is only love. But when you mix it, then it starts to lose its quality or transform its quality. It becomes mixed. It becomes changed. It becomes transformed. If you take water in its pure state, rainwater in a clean state or clean place, rainwater is water as pure as it can be in its purest state. It's very different than water that comes up from the earth. Rainwater is distilled water. There's no minerals in it. There's no elements in it. It's completely pure water. Water that comes from the earth is mixed with minerals. Yet mineral water has value. Sulfur water, for instance, or salt water, these things can help cure you in different ways. They have a purpose, but they are not pure water if you are looking for pure water. Now, love, that energy of love, is always mixed with your own consciousness and the consciousness of the one you love. And depending on the consciousnesses in the relationship, you could, if you wanted to, start to qualify the love accordingly as being pure or less pure or whatever. Now, there is love. We do recognize there is certain love which is very motivated, which means I will love you so long as you deal with me like this. That is called motivated love. That means there's a reason for the love. And that's kind of like what Krishna told the gopis when he left them, that's business love. That means I love you and you get something out of it. You pay something. There's some payment. There's some exchange like that. It's a business arrangement. And then there is love that simply is, just because of the nature of the people, just purest kind of a love. In that sense, divine love is like that because it is not motivated. There is no expectation of return. And that kind of love is just love which is given because it's there. It's just a feeling that is there and it wishes to be given without expectation of return. It's kind of like when you wish to be of service to others, but you'll only be of service to others if there's some kind of return coming from it. So that it all boils down to the differences, your expectation of return, your motivation. If there's a motivation behind it that is somehow or another including some expectation of return. And I don't mean just expectation of being loved in return. That's not necessarily what I mean. But some other kind of expectation. Then it's not divine. There's probably more that one could say about that, but I don't feel like getting into it right now because it would ruin what I just said. And I liked that very much as it was, so I'll just leave it that way.